And welcome back to At the Devil's Ball, where we talk about horror and horror-adjacent properties in a thoughtful, constructive manner, or at least we try to. I'm Samuel Numine. With me, as always, is my co-host and founder of The Feast, Nathaniel Johnson. How you doing?
Hey, we're here.
So, yes, we're here in our themeless Halloween month.
Yeah, mostly. This is, I think, the only movie we're doing that doesn't even have anything to do with Halloween.
Right, right. I mean, it's fall, though.
Yeah,
it's fall.
And Ginger Snaps was definitely had Halloween in it.
Right.
Yeah.
But anyways, right now we're talking about the cult classic, I guess. Has it been long enough to be a classic? It's definitely a cult. Doesn't have a huge mainstream following, but it should. Kind of a movie that came out almost at the halfway point between Scream in the 90s and Cabin in the Wood in the 2010s. Mm-hmm. Of course, talking about Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. Mm-hmm. I always want to say Leslie Jordan. So if I do that during the show, just ignore me.
Okay.
I'm an idiot. Sure. So, yeah, this is kind of half a mockumentary and half a straight-up slasher film.
Yeah, slasher.
Quite clever, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the more clever of the genre, of if you're talking about deconstructive.
I agree.
Horror films. I think actually in a pure thoughtfulness respect, I think it actually would probably beat out both Scream and Cabin in the Woods in a fist fight.
I agree. I think it's a stronger deconstruction than Scream is. And I'm sure we'll get to that, but yeah.
Well, before we get to it, do you want to do the vital stats?
And we'll do the vitals and then we'll go on. So the film was written and directed by Scott Glosserman. It was co-written by David J. Steve. The cast, we've got Nathan Basil, a fellow Nathan, as Leslie Vernon, Angela Goethals as Taylor Gentry, clever name. We got Zelda Rubinstein, we've got Robert Englund, both of them showing up in kind of cameo roles.
This is Zelda's last film, too.
Was it really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, great Zelda Rubinstein. Yeah. And we got Scott Wilson, Bridget Newton, Kate Miner, Ben Pace, and Britton Spellings. Those are the main cast.
Right.
So it's a deconstruction film.
So we'll set up the premise real quick. Sure. Before we start getting into the nuts and bolts of it. Just if you haven't seen it, please stop right now and just go see it. It's really something that you don't want spoiled beforehand, because there's really a good number of very clever twists, including just a huge third act twist that holds together remarkably well.
Yeah.
So we start off with some college journalism students making basically like a fake 2020 or Dateline NBC documentary about serial killers, but more specifically slashers.
Yes.
And this is a world where slashers exist. They took the time to go to Hollywood, California to film a couple scenes in front of, like, the Elm Street house and
with
Crystal Lake, and
with the sole occupant of the Elm Street house being Kane Hodder.
Right. So we get to they talk a little bit about the history of slashers, and again, this is a world where slashers just are that exist.
Yeah, Freddy exists, Jason exists, yep. Michael Myers exists. They all mention them.
Chucky. They mentioned Chucky.
They do mention Chucky too as well. Yeah, they don't mention whether or not the supernatural elements. They just kind of say like these. Well, guys
they kind of say that there's not. But anyways, so their story is that they're going to be allowed to come along on a kind of a ride along with an up and coming first time slasher in Leslie Vernon and what is it, Glen Echo? Glen Echo, maybe it's Oregon, and maybe it's, I can't remember the state it actually took place in, but sometimes they screw up and say Oregon. In like newspaper clippings. But it's another slasher based on like an urban legend, but you find out as the story progresses that maybe things aren't what they seem.
That's true. Yep.
Yep.
Yep. That is essentially the idea. So it's a mockumentary film crew following around a guy who is going to be the next Michael Myers. He's got himself a legend lined up. He's picked out a final girl, which is talked about very heavily about what the final girl is, what she means, why she's there. And he's going to murder her pretty much on camera for the most part. He walks the film crew through the whole plan, marvelously talking about the whole slasher movie experience from the perspective of the slasher. You know, he goes
from,
through the whole,
from a guy who's working the job.
You know? And he's going to, he explains how all these things that have all those things that seem stupid in slasher movies, why they happen, how they happen. Right. He makes them happen. Yeah. You know, he,
you know, real early on, he has that little scene where he's doing the kickboxing with the sandbag or whatever, and he's talking about all the cardio he has to do to be able to chase down these victims and look like they're he's walking the whole time, which was I think the point the first time I watched this movie where I fell in love with it, because I'm like that's just, that's brilliant and hilarious at the same time.
And he's also kind of like talking about he also manages to get that effect by figuring out where they're going to go and being able to like cut them off, you know, at key intervals.
It's like a red, it's like a red light, green light. Cause like he knows what they're going to look behind them. So he stops running at that point.
And he sets up the whole area. He's got booby traps. He's cut branches. It's all designed to basically create the slasher movie cliches. And then he immediately, they eventually figure out, of course, that he's got a different plan in mind, which we'll get to. We will spoil it. So if you are going to watch the movie, go watch the movie. Or if you haven't seen the movie, watch the movie. Because, of course, the ending is the person he's after is not the person we think it is. And but yeah, where do we start breaking this down? I mean, I guess we've already kind of started talking about Leslie Vernon himself.
Right. Well, I would start with the camera crew. I mean, they're kind of the first characters we get. Like I said, they're obviously college students. And you know, even the woman who's, you know, the anchor basically of the documentary is saying, "Oh, you know, do I sound too Diane Sawyer? I don't want to sound like her." You know, so they're trying to find their voice. They're trying to find an angle. So, I mean, they do a lot of work with her right away to establish her as a character, but you do get to know the sound guy and the camera guy pretty easily just through their interactions when they're not recording.
Yeah.
Even though you don't see them on the screen, you hear them.
We see them in the end. Taylor Gentry, that's her name, our main character. And I immediately was like, oh, that's clever. Gentry, for you, the uninitiated, gentry means it's basically a respectable person beneath nobility, not common folk, but not nobility. It's very clever because she's very Pollyanna. She is very, very, she's literally chaste, we find out.
Right.
She is, and is very, very moral. Which drives the climax of the film.
Right. What also drives the drama up until the climax? Because, you know, she's the one who keeps being like, well, wait, should we really be doing this? Should we really?
Yeah.
You know, even if we're taking part just as a documentary crew, we're still responsible for not stopping this.
Right. And it's which is one of those things that always confused me about the movie. This last watch through, it made a little bit more sense to me, but it was sort of like the idea of like, well, okay, I mean, we are accepting the reality that slashers exist.
Right.
And I find myself wondering, I was like, well, do they think he's not going to do it? Is that why they're continuing to follow him?
I think it's just because they haven't, you know, wrapped their brain around the reality of the situation. I mean, there's one thing to know, in theory, that you're going to go watch a serial kill.
Right.
But then to actually like be there for it is another experience entirely. It's like being in danger. You don't know what your reaction is going to be unless you're in danger.
Right. Yeah. It's just, it just always kind of threw me off a little bit. It worked for me a little bit better this time than it did prior. I think this was probably only the third time I've seen it. Maybe even the second time I've seen it. I saw it when it first came out, and I think that was I may never watch it again. Like Ginger Snaps, it's a movie I don't rewatch all that frequently.
No.
I like it fine, but it was never a movie that did that really connected with me that much, outside of me going, oh, very clever.
Right.
You know, and it is, it's absolutely clever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, so it's the character this time around, I will say that the character of Taylor Gentry worked better for me than I think it did the previous one. That she, I think we really like her.
Yeah.
And we kind of sympathize with the dichotomy of the moral implications of what she's doing versus the curiosity.
Right.
You know, that on one hand, it's like, I know he's going to be killing people, but at the same time, I want to know.
Right.
See, and it's very important that, you know, her relationship with Leslie as well, yeah. As the film progresses, which is something that I think I didn't quite land with me when I saw it before. This time I was like, oh, I, you know, there is a very much a sort of romantic attraction.
Yeah. It's kind of a courting. Yeah. In a way.
Yeah. That she, and it's very, very pronounced. It's actually, well, it's not really pronounced. It's actually quite subtle, but it's there. I think it was like after his first kill on camera, he's killed, Zelda Rubinstein,
right,
in the library, and Robert Englund shows up and he's like, I've got my Ahab, and he's dancing around outside excited, and she like hugs him and they're like jumping up and down together, and I'm like, he just murdered a man, Taylor, just murdered a little old lady, Taylor,
and she's just excited because he's excited. He's excited, you know, it's because she's like, we got an Ahab, what's an Ahab
yeah. And he's like, oh, I've got my Dr. Loomis, they don't call him that. But, you know, Robert Englund clearly doing Donald Pleasance in this movie.
Oh, even in the costume design. I mean, it's obviously, and
bald head,
you know,
trench coat.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And that's another thing that of course, the movie is textbook of like what slasher movies are, where he's like, he literally talks about like all the preparation, all that, but also all of the things need to line up. Like he's like getting a nemesis, getting an Ahab. Getting the guy, the old psychiatrist who wants to put him down is so important to him. You know, the guy who comes in to give exposition, you know, and how excited he is for that. What was the other major thing that you brought in from slasher movies that most of them ignore?
Well, I mean, the whole thing that it's based on a pre-existing urban legend is something that's always, you know, almost always in these classic slasher films. I did like the way that he worked that into his plan, not only by, you know, taking the mantle of this local legend, which, spoiler alert, he's not. Also, spoiler alert, the timeline of the legend doesn't make any sense because it would have happened in the 70s when the kid would have been killed.
He says that eventually when they call him on, he's like, yeah, if you think about it, then the numbers don't add up. Yeah. I'm way too young to be this guy.
Well, even so, like, you know, our original, I guess our red herring final girl, you know, says that this guy would have been like her uncle. It's like, okay, well, you're like 16. this is put into the late 70s, early 80s, where this is like a Salem witch trial kind of story where they take a child and throw him over a waterfall. But anyways, I'm sorry. Zelda Rubinstein, having her come in to do the exposition of the legend is pretty, pretty cool and pretty smart, because like this kid should know about the legend, but she really doesn't. And I think that's kind of one of the weaker points of the film, is that this kid who's partying at this house doesn't know the famous legend of Leslie Vernon, but Zelda Rubinstein tells the whole story of this thing. And he couldn't have planned her to say everything that way.
No.
So this is already, you know, he knows what the legend is already and is molding himself to fit that.
His plan was that Zelda Rubinstein would bring her to the microfiche and she'd read the article and find out about the story.
She'd find out about the uncle. I mean, she had to tell the story.
Connection. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I guess you're right. But yeah, a lot of that is a problem. I mean, this guy's like, you know, Leslie Vernon in this movie is sort of like the Joker in The Dark Knight. Like, it's sort of like, how the hell do you know?
Well, yeah, he's definitely like, you know, the trope. I'll forgive the trope of the, the god genius psychopath in this, because it's obviously knows that what it's doing. But yeah, he's like, you know, up there with like Hannibal Lecter or the Joker or,
yeah,
you know, any of these other.
I know exactly what everyone's going to do at all times. I'm like, there's right. no way you can yep. predict. I mean, you can manipulate the board as much as you would like.
Yeah.
It's actually a line from, I know you're not a fan, but there's a line from Angel, the TV show Angel, where
I'm not a fan. I've just never seen it.
But a villain at one point tells them all that in the fourth season that their entire adventures thus far has basically been manipulated by outside forces.
Right.
And one of the characters, Gunn, basically says they're all like, well, what do we do now? And one of the characters, Gunn, says it doesn't matter how much you rig the game. You never know who's going to score a point. You can rig everything you possibly can.
Yeah.
All it takes is that one free throw.
It helps to sell it at this, because there's so many points when he's, you know, laying out the next step of the plan or the plan in general, where he's like, you know, this could all go sideways. It never works out the way it should.
Yeah.
So they lampshade it well enough to where I think it's acceptable that he's got this level of control over everything.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that ultimately he's like, not only did he have control of that situation, but he has control of an entirely other situation.
Right.
And I'm like, okay. I mean, like, granted, and that's actually more on the fault of the characters. Cause that's the thing that bothered me this time, was at the end when they're like, why don't we just go ahead and spoil it?
Yeah.
So the final girl is actually not the girl he's after. It's Taylor. He had the plan the whole time was for Taylor to be the final girl character.
Right.
And this whole thing has been a big dance to get
the whole camera crew has been an attempt to up the game of the slasher again by bringing in, you know, elements of, you know, what was popular at the time, the found footage films and the mockumentary horror films, again, kind of a stroke of genius to blend those two together like that. But yeah, the plan was always that the camera crew is part of it.
Yeah, you guys are actually the real victims. You're who
documentary people. Yep.
And so
everybody else that we've shown is just him trying to bump up his numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. But then the thing is that the characters, they figured this out and they're like, okay, we're the actual target and everybody else is in danger. So they try to help the other characters. And then they're like, well, they know what his plan is going to be. So they try to plan around what his plan was going to be. And I'm like, no, do the exact opposite of that. Do what, like, don't, you know, they're like, well, now there's someone that has to go down there. Right. And I'm like, no, don't. In fact, the only character that gets it right, in my opinion, is the heavyset cameraman.
Oh, hell yeah, Todd,
who ultimately gives his life to try to save everybody.
Right.
By saying, like, all right, he said the one rule, nobody gets
it. But even he could, you know, escape the universe, because what did he do? He ran in one direction, he got tired, he tripped, and he fell. Yeah. Just like a girl in high heels would have in a Friday 13th film.
Yeah. But my point is, he's the only one that even attempts to subvert the plan. Yeah. Where he says, okay, the plan is we all have to sit around here and run from place to place. He's like, well, let's go that way.
Right.
And then he yells, you know, Leslie, your number one rule is nobody gets away. It'll embarrass you. Come get me.
Right.
You know, and then, but I don't think he ever intended to get away. I think
he was
going off the plan.
Trying to get the others away. I think it was just a bit of bravery. And I don't think that was part of the plan, because that was something he picked up from Eugene. Not from, you know, Leslie.
Yes. The running off in one direction. Yeah. The older slasher Eugene that is like the parents of Leslie Vernon. Do tell them they like, you know, they want the number one answer to how do you survive people like us? Pick a direction and run and don't stop until you see daylight.
Right. He's like, don't hide. We'll find you.
Don't hide to find you. Don't fight us. We'll beat you. You know, the only answer is pick a direction, run. Right. And don't stop
or not be there in the first place. Like the wife said, like, don't hang around with virgins.
And that's always the thing that I've always said. People have always asked, what kind of said to me as a horror film geek, they're like, well, Nathaniel would probably survive a horror film. And I'm like, there's one of two answers to that. One is no.
Yeah.
I have, as Senor Chang in Community once referred to himself as, I got the body of a fifth grader. I have no real ability to stand that. But then I was like, the only way that I would be pick a direction, run, don't stop until I see daylight. That would be the only option. And I was like, that would also involve me being an asshole because I was leaving everybody else to die. But I'm like, honestly, the answer is no, of course not. But the only logical win, and that's my favorite thing about this movie, is that line of the smartest way to survive, pick a direction, run, don't stop till you see daylight.
I mean, it's the same. And ironically, it's the same advice we've been getting the last 10 years about shooter situations in real life. You know, you run, you hide, or you fight, and in that order. If you can't run, you hide. If you can't hide, you fight.
That's the thing that was my favorite thing about this whole movie was the father character kind of being like, no,
you're gonna, yes. You I mean, gotta, Scott Wilson's awesome to begin with.
He's great. Great actor.
You know, he's always been and to cast him as very patronly old man who's, you know, likable and fatherly and but you do get to see these moments of darkness, like when he's talking about all the hack killers who get caught or get killed and it makes them all look bad, and he's cutting vegetables at the time, and they show back to him like you just hear all this foley of like, you know, Iron Chef times 20.
Yeah, he's vocalized it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like this, it's pepper dust at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I did look up to see who he was supposed to be, and I didn't quite understand the answer I got. Mm. I guess he was implied, at least in the script and by the filmmakers, as being the killer from Black Christmas.
Okay. Billy?
And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, okay. Nothing. I always thought he was like kind of like more of like a Leatherface kind of character, but I guess so. If you want,
it never occurred to me that he would actually be anybody. Right. You know, I just thought it was.
I was trying to figure out like what his general type of slasher would have been if he was, you know, doing it for folks like Jay and Mike. and Fred up the game.
Fred up the game. Yeah.
It was get in, kill a bunch of people, get out, don't ever come back to the same place.
And that was actually something of foreshadowing about what was going to happen with Taylor too, because it's implied his wife was his final girl.
Right.
She was the one to beat him.
I mean, if you really want to read too much into it, and sure, why don't we always do that? He does say, you know, you caught me. So maybe you could even have an interpretation where, like, maybe she was like another, you know, slasher, and they met on an accident.
She said something to the effect that she was a victim at one point.
Right.
I can't remember exactly what the line was, but she did say like, it's when about by the time she says like, don't hang out with virgins or bad news. She says like, you know, I learned that the hard way. And
right.
He's like, you know, and she laughs and he's like, oh, well, you got me though. Like,
yeah.
But she was clearly involved at some point.
Yeah. I would say she was a final girl that he fell in love with.
Because there could be an interpretation. They're always that's sort of the point. They're always in love with their final girl.
Right.
So that's sort of the idea, is that the idea is he spent the whole movie developing this relationship with Taylor, and this whole time we've got what he's hoping the future will be right there in front of him the whole time. And he's like, this is what we're hoping for, is because he clearly intends to survive. And of course the credit sequence reveals that he in fact does. The final girl does beat him, but thinks she kills him, and he does not. He's fine. He's planned that ahead. Plan to survive.
Yeah, and they also showed it in the movie where, you know, how these killers can survive, you know, quote unquote, being dead even long enough to go to the morgue.
Yeah.
I think that was kind of the germ of how they got Eugene into the film in the first place. They needed to show how.
Yeah, I agree.
How stuff like that is done, because when we meet, when we go to meet Eugene, the Leslie goes to his house and, you know, to talk to him, and he's like, oh, you know, talking to the wife. Oh, where's Jeannie at? Was it Jeannie or I don't know?
Just called him.
Gene. He's like, oh, he's out back. You know, they're like, they go to the woods and get a shovel and they dig him up.
He's been in a coffin.
He's been basically in a coffin, and they're like, oh, how long have you been down here? You know, 3 days.
Yeah, because he learns to slow down. They compare it to like Tibetan monks who were able to slow down their breathing and heart rate to the point of death and be fine. One of the many conceits of a movie that is making a ton of them. But yeah, it's and it's all, it's like I said, it's all very clever, but the idea is that we have this relationship between him and Taylor. Clearly the hope is that after this is all over, they'll understand each other and we'll be together. Although there's a wonderful, there's some wonderful digging.
I don't know if I buy that. I don't know if I agree. I think maybe we're meant to think that, but I think his plan really didn't go past the final girl thing. Like he just,
I'm not talking about plan. I think hope.
Right.
I think
he was just breeding her to be the perfect final girl and to defeat him. I feel like him being defeated by her was what he wanted and was the last part of what he wanted.
But he courted that connection.
Yeah.
Beyond just final girl. I mean, like literally like when he's like, he's sharing private moments with her. Right before he's about to go, he puts on his makeup and they're sitting there and he's like, I'm so happy. And this is
my Christmas.
Yeah. And then she reaches up to embrace him and then gets uncomfortable and grabs his hand instead.
Right.
You know, and he kind of notices it. I mean, I think that the whole thing of that, the way he's interacting with Taylor is, and he's also like, he's being coy about it when he's talking about, you know, final girl then picks up the weapon. She's reaching for my weapon.
He always calls the final girl her, and you know, never specific either. And
yeah. But he's like, she picks up my weapon. You know, she's reaching for my weapon, you know, wink, wink, wink.
Right.
You know, what am I talking about, Taylor? I'm talking about sexuality. And Taylor's getting flustered, but at the same time, I think that he's kind of saying like, this is like, you know, we're connecting on a romantic level,
right?
That will be played out as the final girl. But I think he's hoping that at some point on the other end, they will become like Eugene and.
I suppose so.
I think that he's, I don't think he's, if he just wanted a regular final girl.
I think the idea of his romance is just to have the final girl fight him. I don't know if he has a normal human type of idea of romance.
I think he does, only because also like she's like, you know, you love her, don't you? And he says, I love the idea of her.
Right.
I think that there's an idea too that part of the idea here that we're seeing the dichotomy between the two of them is both of them are not comfortable with their sexuality.
Right.
They are not, either one of them have found themselves in terms of romance, that the connection between them is more. And like I said, I don't want to get hung up on the idea of him having a plan about this.
Right.
I think it's something that maybe he hopes that he will find this girl like Eugene did. And then I think that part of him hopes it's Taylor because Taylor's in the same boat he is. They both haven't figured themselves out yet. It would not shock me if there had been a line that it wasn't in there of him being a virgin as well. That no one has ever understood me because I'm a psycho killer, but no one's ever understood Taylor either, you know, or Taylor has never understood herself, to the point that I feel like what we're getting at here is sort of the idea of these two are falling in love in a way that they can't figure out how to make that work.
Right.
And both of them know it. And it leads to some of my favorite parts of the movie. Actually, I think this time around, my favorite part of the whole movie was that scene where they're sitting there looking out and he kind of cries a little bit and he says, I'm so happy. And she reaches up to like touch his head and she doesn't want to. She ends up grabbing his hand instead because ultimately she's like, I'm totally in love with this psycho guy. And that makes me uncomfortable. And he's like, I'm totally in love with this girl, but I'm going to have to try and kill her in 20 minutes. And I think that there's a hope that's for both of them deep down inside. There's a hope that one way or another, this is going to end up okay, that they could maybe see what happens. And I think that his euphoric, I asked you after I watched the movie, I texted you, can the card be, you know, Taylor, I knew you were the one. That moment of him look in the Apple Press looking at the camera, I loved it because I thought that it was the exact representation of what I'm talking about. Like it was the idea of like, I knew you were the one, not just the one for Final Girl, but the one that I'm like, that I think I understand myself with you. It's romantic in a weird, sick, fucked up kind of way. It's not quite, you know, Nicolas Pace's what was the name of that movie? It was a wonderful, it came out a couple of years ago. It was a wonderful sort of serial killer meet cute movie with Mio Waka. I can never pronounce her name. But anyway, it was really good. It was short, but it was quite good. But it was basically about two people that a guy gets a call girl with the intention of killing her, and it turns out she's just as nuts as he is, and sort of turns the tables on him. And the whole movie sort of ends with the idea of these two people who both are murderous psychopaths sort of being like, oh, we love each other, don't we? Like, we have a relationship now. I think that Leslie Vernon's actually, and it's actually brought me a lot around on the movie a little bit, that I think this is a love story. And
I think it's kind of one-sided at the end. I don't think it's in the moment,
but she found what he hoped she would find at the end of that movie. Like she went through the whole process.
Yeah, so she went through his idea of love, but not her own. I mean,
but she doesn't know
the part of the plan that becomes the plan. So that doesn't make it okay.
I'm not talking about judgment calls here. I'm not talking about good or bad. I think
his plan wouldn't work if she didn't reject him at the end.
She rejects him for that period,
right?
But chances are, so did Eugene's. She rejected him once too. She caught him. She fought him. She fought against him once. It's almost certain,
right?
You know that. Ultimately, I mean, as Robert Englund even pointed out, we think, you know, Nancy from, you know, he's like, there's always a dance. There's always a romance to agree. Right. Although with Freddie, of course, it's way more, you know, rapey. But, right, you know, whereas this movie, it wants to talk about a little bit more of romantic aspect of these, of two people finding themselves in this really unlikely scenario. And that's very clever. To me, it's right, probably more clever than the deconstruction, in my opinion. I was like, well, you're now taking the subtext
of the sexual
subtext of the final girl and turning it into romance, which is a very, very odd thing to do and a ballsy thing to do. I don't think another movie would be, and it's only because this movie is so tight tongue in cheek that I think they can get away with it. But that's my take anyway. I feel like there's a love story happening here. And I think that if we could look a year into the future of this movie, there's a possibility they're together.
Right.
I think there's a possibility that she would realize that she has become the woman she is meant to be as a result of her trial by fire. And that she can now reconcile the way she feels about Leslie. The way he can reconcile the way he feels about her. And that she will be.
Maybe.
But that's just me. I'm a romantic guy. I want to believe those crazy kids made it work. You know, murderous psychopath killed everybody else in that movie dies. Every single person.
Right. Except for his parents. And
yeah, except for the other evil people.
Parental figures, I should say, not his actual parents.
Well, that's not true. I'm lying. No, Robert Englund survives and so does the other cameraman.
Right.
The producer. Who says he's in love with Taylor,
right?
Before Leslie takes him out, but Leslie doesn't actually kill him. He actually survives.
No, he just kind of knocks him out.
Yeah. To the degree that I actually kind of wonder if Leslie would have let them live, both of them live, if the other guy hadn't made a run for it, if he liked them enough to let them slide. They were always kind of incidental, I guess.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it would have been entirely up to that. But if they had tried to make a run with it, yeah, he probably wouldn't have gave a shit because he was focused on, you know, killing the dead teenagers, getting the dead teenagers trope out of the way, and going after the final girl. I think if they would have just, you know, peaced out, they probably would have been okay because they're not the main focus of him at this point.
Although they couldn't. They would not be able to because he took the spark plugs out of the van.
Right. So, yeah, but I mean, if they just decided they were going to walk off in one direction and not announce it, and he was chasing the other one, you know, that's just.
Yeah.
You know, he won't give a shit.
Will they fight to protect Taylor or not? If they don't,
right,
I don't need to kill them. Yeah. If they do, but he didn't kill him. So maybe he would have let them both live. Maybe he liked them both. they certainly were didn't fit any of the criteria.
Right.
Like he even pointed out that he needed not only the final girl to be the right totem, but everybody else needs to be the jock, the stoners, the slutty best friend. They all have to be there in order for him to pull it off. All of the archetypes have to be there. And these two guys, although, as you pointed out, there's a little bit of that found footage aspect of these are the new archetypes.
Right.
Of this type of
movie. And even they hit that because they got, you know, the smart ass camera guy and the sound guy who doesn't talk all that much, but when he does, he's kind of awkward.
Yeah. And they're both morally ambiguous up until the very end. And they're both very much lesser figures into the narrative, whereas the woman in front of the camera is always the one that's the most important. It's very Blair Witch Project, where Heather is important. The other two are kind of schmucks, you know.
At least in the start,
I guess it's been forever since I watched Blair Witch Project, but I didn't really like Blair Witch Project. But as a deconstruction, I think we alluded to this earlier. We might as well rip this Band-Aid off as well. That I think this is better than Scream. I think this is a better deconstruction than Scream.
The Scream didn't really feel to me like it was trying to deconstruct it in the same way as this film does either.
Yeah.
I feel like Scream was trying to be more of a comedy horror than an actual deconstruction of the film. So I'll lay off it in that respect. But I mean, this is smarter.
I agree.
This is deeper, obviously. Yeah. They go into, you know, Yannick imagery at the end at one point.
Yeah, he calls it by name. Yeah.
Which obviously this movie isn't the first thing to ever talk about the phallic and Yannick ideals of slasher films. Even in the mid-2000s, it was kind of a trope for think pieces to talk about it. But Scream.
The 1980s.
Yeah. I mean, right, yeah.
Carol Clover wrote Men, Women, and Chainsaws in like 89. Right. Yeah.
Which is a great book. One of the best on horror.
Yeah.
But I think Scream was, aside from trying to appeal to everybody, a mainstream audience, which mainstream doesn't necessarily mean bad guys.
No, not at all.
But it's going for those lower hits for like, oh, you know, never say I'll be right back. Never, you know, do this. But this movie suffers a little bit and fall apart in the third act as well. And a lot of these deconstructions do. But Scream like almost completely has to like throw out any semblance of sense to work in the third act.
Yeah. I will tread carefully on this subject because it's a good way to get yourself killed.
I like Scream. It's not my favorite movie too. It's an amazing amount of fun to watch.
Yeah.
Even if Jamie Kennedy has always been kind of annoying. But that's his job here, so it works.
It's kind of the point.
But I mean, like, just like all the twists of the end, you know, where they're like, oh, well, your mother slept with my father, and this is why we had a divorce, and this is why I'm killing you, but also I'm killing you for no reason. And it's Kevin Williamson fucking wrote it, so of course it's going to be way more complex than it needs to be.
Yeah.
Whereas this is just, you know, simpler, and it holds up better because of that in a common sense kind of way.
I'm with you on that. I've always objected a little bit to Scream even being called a deconstruction because to me, a deconstruction has to be.
It has to say something about it, first of all.
Yeah. It has to say not only what they are, what the tropes are, but why they're there. Mm-hmm. And Scream doesn't really do that. Scream just sort of says, here's all the things that happens in a slasher movie.
Yeah, it just riffs itself, basically.
Yeah, it's metafictional representation.
Riffing, basically.
Yeah, like they're like, here's what happens in a horror movie, now we're going to do that, or we're not going to do that. One of those two things is going to happen. You know, this movie or Cabin in the Woods, as you mentioned, are two films that are very much evolving the concept of here's what the tropes are, but here's also what they mean, why they're here in these movies, what they represent in pop culture, in psychology, and Scream, I think, is a very, very fun movie. It it's always been a little bit, I think, overblown in that respect, as like, you know, it always drives me. That's one of my pet peeves, is the idea of, like, you know, people say Scream revitalized the horror genre. I was like, it did not. It revitalized box office receipts for horror genre. And yes,
it revitalized the slasher genre. I'll give it that.
I would give it that. The subgenre, the slasher movie had been dead for probably 5-6 years by then.
And the slasher film dies every 5 or 6 years because it's just a genre film. And again, I love slasher films, don't get me wrong, but it's always been a cycle of popular happens, everybody remakes that slasher film for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then another popular slasher film happens and, you know, wash, rinse, repeat. And
yeah. If we ever did an episode of Scream, I would list off all the movies that I hate because Scream exists.
Right. Yeah. Scream,
but
it almost ruined my love of horror for the late during the late 90s in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because so many bad Scream knockoffs were coming out. And
true.
Again, that's kind of like saying Saturday Night Live stopped being funny the year I left middle school. Everybody says that,
right,
in their own way.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah, I mean, in 1980 were like, you know, mad about all the Halloween knockoffs that came out, you know.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. I mean, the slasher movie did, like, as you said, it does die usually every 5 or 6 years because of that.
Right.
You know, the genre reaches a particular zenith and then diminishes until it can be revitalized or reimagined.
And that's part of the reason I wish this had gotten a better release than basically no release. I think it played a couple of festivals. It played a couple of obligatory theaters, and then it just went to Anchor Bay. And, you know, if you weren't a horror fan already, you weren't going to find it, really.
Yeah, I don't even remember how I found it. I think it was talked about online somewhere.
Yeah.
There's this really fun, like this really good movie out there called Behind the Mask.
Right. Yeah, that's how I found it, because, you know, reading horror sites. But again, I'm already a horror fan.
Right.
You know, so I'm already looking for new thrills.
The only thing I've read was that a sequel was hoped to be crowdfunded and it never got
there. That was actually the first thing I ever supported on Kickstarter.
Oh yeah.
was the sequel to this.
Behind the Mask. Yeah.
I was so bummed. And now it's way too late. Even the filmmaker said that this was, you know, the sequel is planned to be partially a commentary on stuff like Saw. And even Saw can't Saw anymore. regardless of how many times they try.
I can't say for sure that's true. I never saw any past the second one. So
I just meant they don't get the butts and seats. They're kind of past that. This last one did because of, you know, Chris Rock and Morgan Freeman. It was Samuel L. Jackson.
But I thought even the one before that, I thought it did pretty well.
Not really.
Okay. I thought they were still doing pretty good box office.
I mean, as far as horror films go, they do okay, but it's not, they're never kind of hit what they want them to hit.
Well, for a few years, it became a new Halloween tradition. And they were like, a six movies out like every year. And that was because they were doing a box office. But
yeah.
I mean, the only reason why Ouija got a sequel was because Ouija did extremely well on a Halloween. And here's our Halloween connection. Here you go.
Mm-hmm.
Ouija was the first film did exceptionally well for Halloween weekend. And then they made a sequel with Mike Flanagan.
Right.
And it did okay. But reality was that nobody liked Ouija. It just did really, really, really good box office for Halloween. And they were like, well, we'll make a sequel. It was obviously successful, even though every critic in the country was like, this is one of the worst movies I've seen in years. It just did really well because of the weekend it was released. And the teenage.
But anyways, I feel like,
you know, the kids went to it. But yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we were kind of robbed of a new, like, you know, genre classic by having this.
Yeah, maybe.
Never really getting any airtime. I mean, I don't know if is it streaming anywhere right now.
It's on Shudder.
Yeah. Oh, it is? Okay.
I think it's been on Shudder since Shudder was created. I think it's one of those movies that's been there forever.
Well, good.
I'm glad. Buried in there somewhere. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's I've actually seen it pop up. Oddly enough, we were planning on doing it. I've seen it pop up in a couple of other podcasts in the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, everybody's talking about Rise of Leslie Vernon all of a sudden. Just because we're planning on doing it. But But yeah. Yeah.
But they're doing it in such a way where we don't know
they're listening. We don't know they're listening to us, and we haven't talked about it yet. Right. They're reading our thoughts, apparently.
It's yeah.
The Village of the Damned podcast. You're thinking about hurting us.
Well, because, and I mean, I guess it's not too far afield to think that they are, because, I mean, you know, once we go off the path of, you know, the big slashers, like are all mentioned in this film itself, Michael and Jason and Fred and all that.
Yeah.
Like, this is always one of like the second squad ones that come to mind immediately. Cause it's just like, it's a movie that I've loved since it came out.
Yeah.
Cause it's just unique and well thought out.
It is that. Yeah.
Yeah. And really aside from a little wonky acting near the end with the, fake final girl, I think it's amazingly well acted by everybody.
There's some clever stuff about that actor too, mm-hmm. though. I mean, like the fact that she's actually like 6 feet tall,
right?
Which is actually a you would think is kind of like, wow, that's bad casting for a final girl. It is right. Bad casting for a final girl.
Yeah.
You know, she's blonde and 6 feet tall. That should already tell you she's probably not actually a final girl.
Yeah.
When he actually, they even point out when he's at the school and they're looking at all the people and he sees a girl, mm-hmm. who is absolutely final girl looking.
Yes.
Like, oh, if I hadn't already picked one out, it'd be her. Right. I'm like, yeah, she looks like one. And then he goes over and like the 6 foot tall cheerleader and she's a virgin. Right. I'm like, sure. You know, right. Like the hottest girl in school and she's never got busy. And of course they point right. that out. They make the joke of like, you know, she's like reverse cowgirling.
Yeah.
You know, on top of this guy, I can't remember right. what the euphemism was they had for it, but she was like riding.
Oh, she said she was riding the dirt like a pogo stick.
Yeah, that's definitely not a virgin. That's an advanced move.
Right.
But yeah, it's this time around, the only acting I thought was a little bit off was actually Leslie Vernon himself. There were a couple of scenes mm-hmm. He just didn't work for me the way I kept kind of thinking. It's probably one of my very few real criticisms of the movie is I kept thinking, I'm like, oh, it's not Timothy Oliphant. Like
it well, that's not his fault.
Well, but that's what I mean is it feels like it's like we couldn't get Timothy Oliphant. So we got a guy who can do a facsimile of Timothy Oliphant. It was a scene in particular, like she confronts him on it's not his name. And he grabs her and shoves her up against the van.
Right.
And it's supposed to be really, really intense and scary. And I was kind of like, he kind of looks like he's having a hissy fit. Now, Timothy right. Oliphant, mm-hmm. if it had actually been Timothy Oliphant, it would have been terrible. I would have pissed myself because he's the scariest right. in Hollywood. But case in point, actually, the scene I immediately thought of was in the movie Girl Next Door,
mm-hmm.
which is a terrifying performance by Timothy Oliphant in the middle of this kind of weird, raunchy sex comedy. About right. teenagers, and Timothy Oliphant walks in and basically plays a serial killer. He's not actually a serial killer, nice. But he's a hardened criminal. And there's a great scene where he's in the car with the with this character that thinks they're kind of buddy buddy, and he drives him out to the desert, and then all of a sudden just turns on him and starts punching him in the head. And it's right. Timothy Oliphant, so it's terrifying. He just turns on a dime.
Yeah, I can see that performance in that scene could come off a little light, and I think it's because of. Anytime there's not enough tension in the scene, you probably had a problem in editing for one.
Yeah.
But I think the actor, he basically said that like a lot of his performance is just basically being his own excitable self.
Yeah,
and it's hard to jump from that, you know, excited puppy dog to
he feels a little too soft to me.
Yeah,
throughout the movie,
I can get that. Until he puts on the costume at the end, I think then he sells it really well.
Yeah, in parts. I kind of wish the costume was better looking, but you know, and maybe it's because of the nature of the film where they're showing it leading up to it and stuff. But when he puts on the costume, I was kind of like, you don't look that scary, bro. Like, other than the fact that, you know, that's what I mean is also like, you know, he's just not that physically threatening.
Right.
Even in costume, I'm like, you're a little small. I don't know, you know, but at the same time, if he was running at a guy running at me with a
stick, yeah, I mean, care, the idea he had of performing as Leslie Vernon without shoes has always baffled me. And that was the actor's idea, and he immediately regretted it, apparently, because, you know, you're outside filming in the fall and shoot in no shoes.
Yeah.
Even from like a logistical standpoint, I'm like, why would you do that?
Even pro wrestling, they've usually learned not to do that. Like, was it Rusev, who's now Miho in AEW? Like, he actually broke his foot mid-match, right, because he was wrestling barefoot, and they
made boots. And that's in a controlled environment. I mean, this is
a reasonably controlled environment. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's honestly like performing barefoot's usually just a bad idea in general, unless you're like UFC fighter, like you know, where you're not allowed to wear shoes because they might hurt somebody, but because you're gonna kick people in the face with it.
Here we're talking about him running around like an orchard at a farm and like, you know, dealing with broken windows.
I mean, did we not learn anything? Like John McClane kind of being like, you know, man, I wish I had shoes. It would make actual fighting work better. But it would be a little weird that he would run around with no shoes. I mean, also
one of
vulnerable spot. Like why did Taylor just swing that axe at his foot?
One of Jed and I's first in jokes, which is goes back now 25 fucking years. Mm. Oh my god, is always wear appropriate footwear, because you never want to be in a situation where you have to run after somebody down the street who's drunk or stupid or whatever, and be wearing uncomfortable shoes. And
I actually, in general, hate being without shoes, even in the house. Because
I don't take off my shoes until I'm ready to go to bed.
Yeah, me too. I feel really kind of weird and vulnerable without them. And I think it's I could blame it on my horror movie fandom, I suppose. But
I've got a pair of slippers that almost feel like shoes, and I can force myself to wear those on the weekends. But usually, like, I get up, I put on shoes, I go to bed, I take off the shoes.
I feel like I would blame it on my entire childhood being told what to do in a fire. At any moment, my home could become a raging inferno, and I need to get out. I'd rather be wearing shoes than not. Yeah. Probably for the same reason why Leslie Vernon should be wearing shoes.
It'd be like,
broken glass and the shrubs outside. And, I mean, this guy's actually talking not only like broken windows, but also like climbing through trees and shit. I'm like, you know, and a barn. Did he go through meticulously and make sure there were no nails sticking up out of the ground?
He had a magnet that he just ran across the entire barn area.
Lucky he doesn't get a splinter.
Our slasher died because he had an infected splinter on his foot.
That would have been hilarious if he gets brought into the morgue and it just turns out he's actually got an infected toenail and that's what kills him. You know, survive the arrest.
And then the coroner like removed the thorn from his paw and they became friends.
They became best friends. Yeah, it's a fun film. It's very clever. Like as we said, it's very very smart. It has a lot of, and there's some good humor in it, without being too parody. It does do a little bit of parody because I think a deconstruction kind of has to.
Yeah.
In order to be effective.
It's brave enough to do format changes too, like when it becomes a slasher film, it stops being shot on digital and starts being shot on like 35mm.
The ending
of the aspect ratio changes and everything.
Yeah, the climax of the movie is them putting down the cameras.
Even in like the librarian scene, like
that's true.
They go through the plan and then it goes to the quote-unquote final girl's point of view and it becomes a slasher film again. It also opened with that too. The girl from the final girl coming out of the restaurant and throwing the garbage and throwing the trash in the dumpster. And then not many films do that. And
no,
it's kind of cool when they do.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say even name another found footage movie where the characters stop filming. You can't do it. So, you know, without the cameras continued existence, the film can't continue. It's one of those things. I think we talked about with Henry Cuoto. I was like, we talked about Devil's Trail. Did I say his last name right? I always feel like I screw up his Cuoto.
No, you hit it right the first time.
Cuoto.
No, Cuoto. Oh, well, now we're all going to get flagged.
I don't know. We talked about it with him when we talked about his movie Devil's Trail. It was like where the problem with found footage is always you got to come up with reasons for people to keep filming, and his twist ending of Devil's Trail made it make sense. you know,
right.
Even though I didn't understand the twist ending until he explained it to me, but sorry, Henrique, it's a fun conceit to do at the end of this movie to kind of be like, well, now we're going to just play this straight.
Right.
But yeah, it's a really clever movie. And
check it out on Shudder.
Yeah, it is on Shudder. You can check it out. And worth seeing, although at this point we've ruined the whole movie for you. But
Again, you shouldn't be listening to this if you haven't seen the movie already, because we're
maybe when I put this up on social media, I'll tag Shudder.
Right, there you go.
They can watch it before watch it there before they listen to this episode. But yeah. You have any last thoughts on
No, I think this is an underseen, quite clever film. Scream Factory did a special edition release.
That's right, they did. Yeah.
And that got all the requisite bells and whistles. So pick it up, watch it on Shudder, tell your friends, tell somebody who's kind of on the fence about, you know, kind of horror slasher films to see if they may like this, because I think it's got some crossover appeal that is undervalued.
Yeah, and I think that the best kind of deconstruction is one that can be watched by a casual viewer and be understood, and I think this movie is that.
You know, I'd also like to say that this is the way you do Easter eggs right. You know, a lot of their jokes early out of the film are talking about, like, you know, Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, but it's not just pointing at the thing and saying, you know, look at the thing, you know, the thing I said, the thing.
Yeah.
It's actually like it toes that line between, like, you know, necessary in the plot, but also if you took it out, you wouldn't lose the plot.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That's how you do it. You don't just stop your goddamn movie for flashbacks or
the middle of screaming to look at the camera and be like, the town that dreaded sundown.
Exactly. Yeah, or the whole Star Wars thing where everybody who's been on Star Wars for half a second now has to have, you know, a whole backstory in a new movie. And it's like, just,
yeah.
It's not meant to be the meal. It's supposed to be seasoning.
Right.
And I think it works here.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I got.
Yeah. No, it's a fun film. I definitely recommend it. It's, and that's coming from a guy who's not really a huge fan of slashers in general.
Right.
This one is actually kind of a lot of fun. It has a lot of, it's got the humor, but it's not too jokey. Right. It's got the deconstruction, but it still plays it straight. It's
it doesn't take itself too seriously either, which is appreciated, because it doesn't navel gaze very much, which is nice.
It's high-minded. It's high-minded and intellectual without being a dick about it.
Right.
You know, it's kind of actually almost entirely devoid of pretension, which is actually kind of remarkable for a deconstruction.
Yeah, commendable.
Most deconstructions usually end up can't resist punching down a little,
right? Or start with the conceit that I know more than you, so listen to me.
Yeah. And this movie lays it out very organically, I think. And there's a lot going on for that. There's a lot to be said to that. This is a very subtle, simple movie that's actually got a lot going on upstairs, and that's really cool. So,
and I wish there would have been more stuff to see from Scott Glosterman, and I forgot the writer's name, but they don't have a whole lot of credits at IMDb, which kind of sucks.
Yeah, I guess this movie just wasn't that successful for them, huh? That's too bad.
If you're listening, come on the show and tell us about what you've been doing since, please. We love you. You made an excellent movie.
Absolutely. What's before TM?
That was Before the Mask. That was the sequel.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. It's listed as
in production.
Announced.
It's probably been announced for a decade and a half.
Sorry, guys. Okay. Then I guess I'll take us out then if we're all set to go.
Yep.
Okay. We remind you, as always, so first of all, we say thank you. Thank you very much for listening. Yes. We remind you to keep it positive, keep it constructive, Love yourself, love your fellow horror fans. Don't be dicks, and just
don't hang out with virgins.
Don't hang out with virgins. They're bad news. Yeah, yeah. And remember to pick a direction and start running, and don't stop until you hit daylight. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. And if you don't hear from us again, happy Halloween. Our Halloween specials are up next. But if you don't listen to those, because they're going to be like 4 hours long, then we'll say happy Halloween here. So happy Halloween to you.
And happy Halloween. Check your candy.
Check your candy. There could be like the head from Malignant.
Edibles.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Some. If your kid is getting edibles, find out which house it was and party with that guy. Because that guy is stupid.
It's fucking cool. Yeah.
He's giving away his edibles? Are you kidding? Those things, I don't even know what those are, but they cost like $40 a bag or something. Who would give that away to children?
Nobody. That's the point.
Yeah, children. It would be worthless to children. They don't even. Yeah, like I want to get kids high. Why?
I mean, at least back in my day, razor blades were cheap. I mean,
if you wanted to torture them, like give them like Baby Ruths or something. What the hell?
Right.
Anyway, happy Halloween, and we'll see you next week for a Halloween special, and then we'll see you in November. So thank you very much. Good night, and namaste. Oh,